You're listening to the Tipton Children Podcast.
So, let's start with our motivation. And Chandrakirti often talks about sentient beings in samsara using the metaphor of a water wheel or a bucket in a well. And the bucket goes down very easily, just as sentient beings fall to the lower realms very easily, but takes a great deal of effort to pull the bucket back up, as it takes us a lot of effort to create the causes for good rebirth. The bucket is controlled by a pulley. It isn't free to do what it wants. And so likewise, we're controlled by afflictions and polluted karma. We aren't free to have the kind of life that we want. Just as a bucket gets banged around as it goes down and comes up, we get banged around going from one life to the next. So many unsatisfactory circumstances and being afflicted by the three kinds of dukkha. And just as the bucket goes round and around, we also go round and around. So it's helpful to think of what our situation in samsara is like and really see it as unsatisfactory and want to be free from it. And then by seeing our own situation like this, then it's easy to develop compassion when we think of other living beings' situation being similar. If we don't think of our own situation first, then it's difficult to have compassion for others. And so when we think of other situation, then to generate very strong compassion, that leads us to want to do something, to have a strong resolve to change the situation. And seeing that we need to change ourselves first in order to help others, then we aspire for full awakening so we can free ourselves of all impediments, develop all of our good qualities infinitely. And so no matter how long that takes, no matter what we have to go through to do that, it's something worthwhile. And so we should really step up to the plate with happiness and enthusiasm to practice. Say happiness, enthusiasm, practice, but you have to do things for three countless great eons, and I have to give up my chocolate, and I have to learn how to love all these obnoxious sentient beings. Can't you change the requirements for becoming a Buddha and make it a little bit easier? The path a little bit shorter, you know. This kind of thought, does this come in your mind? You know, like, why can't it be easier? Why can't it be shorter? As if somebody else created the path, you know, and created the structure and created the whole thing and is imposing it on us. Yeah. But the Buddha can't change what the path is. Yeah, because the Buddha didn't create it. This is just, you know, like if you're in samsara and you want to become a Buddha, this is how it works and this is what you have to do. Yeah, there's nobody who can change it or make it shorter or make the, you know, like make the requirements not as stringent. Yeah, kind of ease it out for me, you know. Don't you have some remedial kind of shortcut classes for Buddhahood? Yeah. No. Yeah, the path is what it is. And so that's why I said we really have to step up to the plate, and no matter what it takes, just do it. And no matter how long we have to practice, just do it. Because what else are we going to do? Yeah? When you think that you've been born in samsara countless times, and you've been born as everything in samsara, from the lowest hell realm to the highest spectacular God realm, what else are you going to do? Yeah? It's like there's nothing else to do. So we might as well do something worthwhile. Yeah? Because the only choice is just to, you know, keep eating chocolate chip cookies that are too sweet and getting a stomach ache from them. Yeah? That's the choice. So, yeah? The chocolate chip cookies are good. Yeah? But it's like, they always come with a stomach ache. So, you know, at a certain point we say, maybe I should refrain. Save myself some misery. Okay, so that's why we're studying Nagarjuna's text here. Okay? So, we're on the section where he's talking about the collection of wisdom, the expanded version of the collection of wisdom. So he's been giving us some practical tips for how to approach the collection of wisdom. You know, of course, I mean, the ultimate thing is we have to meditate on the emptiness of inherent existence of persons and phenomena. But he's giving us some tips that are a little bit easier, that help us set up that situation whereby we can do that meditation. Okay? So we're on 268, but, you know, in this section, what he's doing is he's going through, how many? 25 branches, okay, of different practices to do. Okay, so the first one, honor and respect the sutras. Okay, be respectful and humble when you attend teachings. Give texts to people who don't have them. Provide the Dharma for people. Don't enjoy listening to people who criticize and gossip, but enjoy listening to the Dharma. And instead of relishing, you know, worldly conversations, relish Dharma conversations, and encourage others to have that kind of, those kind of conversations, that kind of interest. Okay? And being satisfied with the Dharma that we've heard up until now. So here's where we can pour all our dissatisfaction. Yeah, we're usually very dissatisfied, aren't we? I don't like this. I don't like that. So we have to pour our Dharma, all of our dissatisfaction into, I haven't heard enough teachings. I want to hear more teachings. You know, I haven't really meditated as I would like to. I want to do that more. Okay? And then, you know, to really try and remember what we study, to analyze what we study, to hold it in our mind. And then to thank our teachers, making offering to them as an expression of, of appreciation for what we've learned. Okay, so that's the previous ones. Now we're on verse 268. So it says, do not study profane philosophical systems such as that of the Travakas. Give up debate that is for the sake of arrogance. Do not speak in praise of your own good qualities, but rather speak of even your enemy's good qualities. Wait a minute here. Okay, not speaking in my own good qualities, that's one thing, but I'm supposed to speak of my enemy's good qualities? So you can see that a lot of these verses where he's talking about how to collect merit, how to collect wisdom, these are the foundation for the thought training teachings, aren't they? Yeah. And so, if we wonder about the origins of the thought training, here they are. Okay, so the 11th of the 25 things for the collection of wisdom expanded. The 11th is do not listen to teachings of the non-Buddhist philosophers who say there's no past and future lives, that the mind is simply the brain, that awakening is impossible. People who have these kind of wrong views don't read and study their treatises with an attitude of interest and so on, because it could really damage your faith in the Buddha. You know, just as we spoke before about birds of a feather flock together, so if you hang around people who keep bad ethical conduct, you're going to soon have bad ethical conduct. So in the same way, if we hang around people who have all sorts of views that are really off the wall, pretty soon we'll start thinking those views are good views. So it doesn't mean that we hate these people. Yeah, it doesn't mean that we avoid them like the plague. It just means that we, there's been some reason why we've decided that the Buddha's teachings are true. And so rather than continue to search around and try this and try that, looking for a system that's better, let's stick with what we've already decided works and go deep in it, okay? In the Bodhisattva vows, it talks about, it's okay to read the treatises of non-Buddhists because, sometimes in order to help other people, you have to read what, their scriptures are so that you can talk to them in a way that makes sense to them, or in order, maybe you yourself have, or some of your friends have some wrong views, so you have to kind of read the scriptures to find out what reasons people are giving for those views so that then you can figure out how they don't make sense, so that you can really help people. So studying the scriptures of the non-Buddhists for that reason is completely fine. Similarly, if you're doing interfaith dialogue, you might want to read something from some of the people you're going to be dialoguing with so that you have some background and you don't come in completely blind. So there are certain situations for reading and studying the scriptures of non-Buddhists. Yeah, but otherwise you don't want to really get into them because you might start believing some of the things because our wisdom isn't so great. And also it consumes a great deal of time to read all of those things. And I remember when I was studying in Dharamsala with Geshe Sona Rinchen, and some of us were saying, but Geshe-la, this sounds kind of close-minded. Like you're only supposed to read Buddhist stuff and other stuff is bad and don't read it. And we believe in free speech. And, everybody can say what they want, everybody can do what they want, you can read what you want. It's, we believe in diversity, we should, you know, read everything and study everything from all sorts of people, and this is our culture. And, you know, what's wrong with it? We're not going to kind of give up our Buddhist beliefs and go over to being some other religion. And Geshe-la looked at us and he said, you know, in ancient India, there was a lot of debate between the Buddhists and non-Buddhists. And the non-Buddhist scholars are very astute. They are not stupid people. And he said, your wisdom may not be as so discerning, yeah? And somebody who is well-trained as a debater and a scholar in another tradition may be able to convince you of one of, you know, some of their views, because your own wisdom is not so sharp. Yeah? It's quite interesting, you know? So like I say, it's not a thing of, you know, we're close-minded. It's a thing of, you know, put your energy where it's going to be best used, you know? Okay, so yeah, let's not use our energy to create all sorts of unnecessary doubts. We already have enough doubts, don't you think? Yeah, so we don't need to create some more. Then the 11th one is to study with a good motivation. Okay, so free of arrogance and competition. So you can see he said, you know, give up debate that is for the sake of arrogance. So, you know, sometimes we may, you know, or put it this way, there's some people who study because they really want to learn a lot so that they can become a big teacher. Yeah? And if I can learn a lot, I can be a sharp debater, then I can be a big teacher. Lots of people will respect me. I'll have some renown. Yeah, that's a completely corrupt motivation. Okay? So Nagarjuna here is saying, you know, study with an attitude, a good motivation to really benefit others, that is free from arrogance and competition. And also, when you debate and discuss the Dharma, do it with the motivation to really help yourself and the other person learn, not with the motivation to defeat somebody when you're debating. So in the Tibetan system, you know, seeing as it's the Nalanda system in Tibet, they follow this tradition of doing a lot of debate. They do it as a pedagogical tool. You know, in ancient India, it was really to decide what, you know, whether the Buddhist views or non-Buddhist views were correct. Now in Tibet, you know, the people are Buddhist, but let's, you know, use it as a tool on how to learn. But then also, as you get deeper and deeper, it does involve kind of, well, which one of the, you know, where do we draw the line here? And which one of these ways of looking at emptiness or looking at a particular point is really the most refined, you know, the wisest? So it's important when you debate to really have that motivation of learning and helping the person you debate or discuss with learn. And they teach this a lot to the young monks and nuns as they debate. The debates get quite heated, yeah, and sometimes they're a lot of fun, and sometimes there might be some ego involved, yeah, and, you know, when you get defeated on the debate ground, you know, then that's kind of humiliating, because you thought you were so brilliant, and somebody else proved your argument is, you know, nothing. And then you take it personally instead of seeing it as, oh, okay, that's good, now I can learn. You think, oh, what's wrong with me? I, you know, nobody's going to respect me as a good debater. Woe is me, I've lost my reputation, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so that can happen. If someone starts getting really inflated on the debate ground, what my friends tell me is that then everybody teases them and makes fun of them. Yeah? And kind of goes, oh, great guru, you know, please enlighten them. Yeah? Because, you know, kind of some kind of arrogance. It's just, I mean, it's rotten. It totally pollutes the practice. So they, and the teachers, also the debating teachers, will then really humiliate somebody as a favor to that person so that they can really practice well. You know, not just as a thing of competition to show they're better, but, you know, to get through to the person that this isn't why we're doing the debate and discussion. So sometimes you have to be tough in order to take it, yeah? And to, you know, acknowledge when you've been defeated in debate, and if you're puffed up, to be able to take it when people make fun of you, okay? And to realize that, that they're doing it for your own benefit. Do you think you can do that, or are you going to get sensitive?
They made fun of me. I'm never going to debate again. They don't appreciate me.
That's what we're like, aren't we? Yeah? We start something, even if it's not debate, we start some project. We make some error and somebody points it out to us and we just throw in our hands and say, I'm never going to try this again, I just can't do it right. Yeah? And it's all attachment to reputation, isn't it? Okay. So we want to become a Buddha without giving up our ego. Yeah? I mean, can't I be a Buddha with some arrogance? Because I really am. I'm better than the other Buddhas. Yeah, that's kind of what we're like. Okay, then number 13 is don't broadcast our own good qualities. Ah, shucks. You know, going around telling everybody, oh, I've done this, and I've studied that, and here I did this and the other thing. And this is really hard in the West, you know, because when you look, when people make the paragraphs or the announcements about Buddha's teachings, they're always written up, you know, not only the teaching is the most exclusive thing, but this teacher is the best, blah, 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 is special in this way, don't miss out, you know. And so everything's really blown up. I mean, it's true, isn't it, in the West? If you go in for a job, if you're applying for a job, you don't go in and, you know, say, well, you know, I don't really know how to do this, but I'll learn. You go in and say, oh, I know how to do this, even when you don't. Isn't it? You know? And so let alone sing our own praises, we claim to have qualities, good qualities we don't have. I mean, this is the way our culture is. And Buddhism is actually totally the opposite. You know, it says don't go around proclaiming all your achievements and all your virtues and all your accomplishments. Yeah? And so, you know, when I look at my teachers, they certainly don't go about doing that kind of thing. They don't come walk in puffed up. I am a Geshe Larampa. I am a Rinpoche. You know, if they do that, it's like, bye-bye. See you around. You know, like there's some guy, was it in California, who says he's Maitreya Buddha. Yeah. Okay, that's good. Bye. Yeah. And some other guy in the Chinese community who's Dorji Chong the second or Dorji Chong the third, something like that. Okay, you know, so we don't broadcast our own good qualities. Kenzo Rinpoche says, be discreet about your own good qualities, and other people may talk about them, but they're not for you to discuss. And then he gives the analogy, a sandalwood tree has a very pleasant fragrance, but the tree itself does not spread its own fragrance. It is the wind that carries the fragrance. Okay. But you don't prime all your friends and students to go out and praise you to the world. Okay. I remember once attending a big teaching by His Holiness, and there were some people there who were disciples of a certain teacher, and they were going, oh, so-and-so, my teacher, I'm sure he's an Arya. You should see how he teaches emptiness. His compassion is beyond what you've ever seen before. He's very highly realized. And I'm going, you know, I mean, I just don't. That kind of advertising really turns me off. Yeah? Tsongkhapa Rinpoche, the young one, you know, he once said, if you're a good cook, you don't need to tell other people you're a good cook. Just invite them for a meal, they'll find out. So similarly, you don't need to, if you have your friends and students go around creating some kind of good false reputation, saying that you're highly realized, blah, 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 blah. And it's actually problematic, because sometimes, I mean, students tend to do that, and, you know, and inflate. I mean, it's one thing expressing your confidence and faith in somebody. That's one thing. It's another thing to advertise. Okay? And so it's the advertising, you know, this over-the-top kind of thing that just really is not, you know, in the Tibetan community, the Chinese community, the Thai community, this kind of thing is not respected at all. Yeah. Over here, if you promote yourself or somebody promotes you, it's like, this is good. I mean, everybody chases after it because it's like movie stars and sports stars. Yeah. But then in doing so, sometimes the people create such an unrealistic expectation of the teacher that the teacher can't possibly live up to it. Yeah. And it puts a lot of pressure on the teacher to be something they aren't. Okay? So I'm not saying go around and criticize your teacher. That's not too smart either. Okay? Yeah, and you can speak of your faith and confidence, but don't advertise and publicize and, you know, my teacher's almost as good as the Dalai Lama. You know? I mean, that's what it sounded like from these particular people. And then, as it happened, a big scandal came about. Okay? Yeah, it was funny because before this person became, you know, quite famous. A mutual friend had, you know, introduced me to this person. You know, always the. And I talked to him, and it's like, I just wasn't. Nice fellow, that's it, you know? And then all these people so enamored. And then, kerplunk. Quite unfortunate. Okay, then, so that was the 13th. The 14th, okay, is do not criticize those you dislike, but speak of their good qualities. Ooh. Ooh, can you do that? You know, okay, I can close my mouth about my own good qualities. If I strut around, they'll see them. But praise somebody else? You know, and especially, why is it we don't like some other people? Is it because it's really that they're so awful? Or is it that we're jealous of them? It's a good question, isn't it? Is it really that what this person is doing is so terrible? Or is it that they're so successful and they have some really good qualities and we're jealous? And so whatever they do, we look and we pick faults. Because if we can pick faults, then we must be better. Okay? So Nagarjuna is saying here that jealousy is very often behind our dislike for somebody. So we should put the jealousy aside, learn to look at somebody accurately. They may have some negative qualities, so do we. But we can still speak about their good qualities. Okay? And it's actually kind of good for us, isn't it, to speak about other people's good qualities. I mean, at first it's so painful. Oh, it's so painful. How can I talk of that person's good qualities? It's like I'm so jealous of them. And besides, they do this and this and this and this and this wrong. Yeah. But actually, you know, when you really work on transforming your mind, when you can praise other people's good qualities, then you actually feel quite happy. Now, there's a certain kind of happiness in training your mind so that you can look around and see people's good qualities and rejoice. And there's a certain kind of happiness that comes when you put down that tendency to compete. Yeah? Because jealousy, arrogance, competition, they're all part of the same thing. Because they all involve comparing ourselves to somebody else, ranking ourselves with somebody else. When we rank ourselves better, we're puffed up. When we rank ourselves lower, we're jealous. When we rank ourselves as the same as them, we're competitive. None of those are very productive or virtuous attitudes. Okay? So as much as we can to pull ourselves out of in the West, what's been inculcated in us since we were kids to compete and to be better than somebody else. Yeah? And to put that aside, you know, the thing is to work on ourselves, improve ourselves, develop our own good qualities. We don't need to compare ourselves to somebody else and be better than them. Weren't you taught since you were little that you have to score 1 point better than Johnny and Susie? Yeah? I've got to show that I'm better. And I'm better at sports. I'm better at my homework. I'm better looking. I'm more popular. I know almost everything. It sounds like adolescence, doesn't it? It is adolescence, and we're grown-up adolescents. And it's a painful state of mind, isn't it? I find that kind of state of mind so painful. Okay, so better put it down. Yeah, I saw myself, one person who I've had a kind of mixed relationship, you know. We sometimes had some conflict and quarrels. On the other time, on the other side, this person helped me, and they were also quite brilliant. And then I saw, oh, they're teaching somewhere, and they're doing this course, and they're doing that course. But I know they're so charismatic when they teach, but they don't really have compassion because they were so mean to me. Yeah. So it kind of like my mind looking at it. It's like, oh yeah, they're teaching this, but they're really not a very good teacher, even though all these people are going to love the course. You know, because I know what he's really like, because he was so mean to me. Yeah. And then I said, oh, jealousy. Yeah. Jealousy. That's all it was. Just jealousy. Yeah. Other people are going to benefit. That's fantastic. True confessions. Okay, verse 270. You should eliminate in yourself those faults that the one...
Did I...
Oh, yes, right. 269. Do not attack what is vital to another, nor make statements with a negative attitude towards others. Instead, examine your own errors. Okay, so number 15 of these 25. When you're discussing Dharma with other people, then don't be obnoxious, okay? When you're talking to people in general, be respectful. Don't press their buttons, you know, don't deliberately offend them. Yeah. If you're somebody's teacher, sometimes you do that, you know, to point something out to somebody. If you trust that disciple enough to know that they're not going to break down in tears and run away. So you don't do it so often. Okay, so try not to be obnoxious, you know. Try to be kind, you know. We've had an incredible example of obnoxious speech in this election cycle, haven't we? Incredible thing, to the point where one teacher said, you know, if this candidate were in my classroom, he would be in the principal's office after 5 minutes. And, you know, it's like this is not the way we speak to other people in elementary school. And this is not the example we want our children to hear. So in the same way, you know, this is not the kind of speech we should practice ourselves. Okay. Then 16, refrain from maliciously talking about the faults of others. Okay. So here in the verse, it says, nor make statements with a negative attitude towards others. Okay, so, you know, don't just be malicious and criticize people and trash them, because they take your words to heart and they're hurt. Yeah, and so, you know, there are certain times when it's appropriate to give somebody feedback. And so we should, you know, choose those times well and give the person feedback when we're confident that they can hear it. And do it in a nice way. Yeah. Instead of, you did this, yeah, to say, you know, were you aware that, da 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 da, or I didn't understand when you said da 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 da, what did you mean? You know, it's very good to present it as a question rather than as an accusation. Yeah. And one thing I learned from when you read the suttas, the Buddha, whenever somebody would come to the Buddha and complain about what somebody else did, the Buddha didn't go to that person and say, you know, I heard you did this. Who in the world do you think you are acting that way? You know, the Buddha went to called that person, and then said, is it true that you did X, Y, and Z? And then the person had a chance to say yes or no. Because sometimes when you hear from somebody else what somebody else did or what somebody else said about you. They didn't understand it correctly, or maybe you didn't understand it correctly. And if you go to the person directly and say, I heard you said, did this about, you know, about me, it's going to be a bad way to start a conversation. Because maybe they didn't do it at all. Or maybe they said something, but the other person totally misunderstood it. Okay, so good to go and ask a question. Of course, what I've noticed is usually when you hear this kind of thing secondhand, you're so riled up from hearing it that you forget that you should go and ask a question and see if it's true. You're so riled up that you go and said, you said this. So it's a good thing for us to kind of slow down, you know, ask the question. And then also part of that, this verse says, you know, when you're you want to just speak badly of someone, look at your own mistakes first. Yeah. So someone once said, turn the mirror on yourself to see your own faults instead of the microscope on others to look at other picky little things. But it's so easy to see other people's faults, isn't it? Yeah. So this is number 17. Examine yourself to see if you have faults or not. Yeah. Who, me? Who, me? I don't have any faults. Yeah. And, you know, it's very clear. I mean, we see so clearly other people's mistakes, don't we? Yeah, but our own mistakes, very difficult to see, isn't it? Very difficult. Yeah. Very easy to point out other people's mistakes, very difficult to own our own. Yeah, immediately defensive. And so it's very good at those times when we're getting defensive to ask ourselves, who am I trying to protect? This is a really good time for the emptiness meditation. You know, I feel threatened. Who feels threatened? Who in the world am I trying to protect? What is this who or what is this person that I need to protect? You know? And why is it so awful if they, receive some criticism? Yeah, I mean, what is so bad about us receiving criticism and somebody pointing out our fault? What's so bad about that? Yeah, I mean, when you really sit, Shanti Deva talks a lot about this, you know, it's like, how is a bad reputation really going to hurt you? And how does a good reputation really benefit you? Because if we have Dharma values, okay, if we have Dharma values, what's important to us? Good ethical conduct, concentration, wisdom, bodhicitta, good rebirth, liberation, awakening. Does a good reputation get you any of those? No. Does a bad reputation prevent you from getting any of them? No. So why are we so wigged out when somebody points out our faults or criticizes us? You know? Because it means at that moment we don't have Dharma values. We have worldly values. And what good in the world are worldly values going to do us? Isn't that why we turned our mind to the Dharma? Is because we saw that worldly values stink? Yeah, and that we don't want to be beholden to, you know, try and become the most famous person, try and look the best, try and be the most loved. You know, isn't that why we turned our mind to the Dharma? Because we saw that having that kind of motivation just makes you crazy, because you're never satisfied. Oh, and then somebody praises you, and then they blame you, so you're on top of the world, then you're down in the dumps. You know, didn't we kind of look at all of that and decide that we didn't want to live our life according to it? So why are we going back to it? Yeah? So, you know, this is, you know, in our meditations, I have little talks with myself. You know, these are my Lamrim meditations. This is what my Lamrim meditations are like. You know, I have a little talk with myself. Basically, I imagine Shantideva there talking to me. Okay? Yeah. I'm sitting there. I'm hurt because somebody else got the glory. Somebody else got to go to, what was that thing called? United State of Women. Somebody else got to go. They didn't pick me. They picked somebody else. I didn't get to meet the president. And I really wanted to have my picture taken with President Obama and Michelle Obama. I really wanted to meet them and shake their hand. That would be so cool. Wouldn't that be cool? Yeah, it's like, I want to go and meet them. Forget about benefiting anybody else. I want to go to that conference and meet them. Yeah, but they didn't pick me. Poor me. You know, that's completely worldly garbage, isn't it? They pick somebody else. And this time I couldn't even say, oh, well, that's because it's an old boys' club. Usually when they don't pick me, it's because they're discriminating against me because I'm a woman. I couldn't say that this time. Actually, I had done some prayers beforehand. There were so, when we watched some of the videos from some of these people, there were some beautiful things that people said. And so many minority women really standing up and doing things. And I thought, better they go. Yeah. But if anybody cancels, you can let me know at the last minute. No, I'm joking. It's okay. So, So the thing is to really examine ourselves and look at our own faults. And Kenzo Rinpoche is also saying here that if we don't look at our own selves, something that is actually a fault, we could think is a virtue. It sounds surprising, but it's very possible that something that is an actual fault in ourselves, we think is a virtue. And I remember reading somewhere, I can't remember where, and it was saying, you have to be careful when you start to teach and share the Dharma with others, because it's possible that your students or the people who are listening to you mistake one of your faults as a virtue. Yeah? And you can see this in some of the scandals that have happened, where the students have done exactly that. You know, that it was a weakness in the teacher, but the weakness supported something in the disciple that the disciple wanted and craved, And the disciple saw that as a virtue and not as a fault. So you have to be incredibly careful. Because just because the world tells us, oh, you're so wonderful, blah, 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 it doesn't mean we are. And similarly, just if the world tells us we're so awful, it doesn't mean we are. Okay? So this is why it's so important to be able to look at ourselves and discern for ourselves, you know, and be honest. Okay, now verse 270. There's a lot to meditate on here, isn't there? You should examine in yourself those faults that the wise always decry in others, and to the best of your ability, eliminate them in others as well. Okay? So this one is, you were usually very sensitive to what worldly people think about us. Rather than that, we should put that aside, but we should think about what the wise people say, the people we really admire, the people we consider wise. What faults do they decry? What faults do they say, point out that we should abandon? Okay? And then look inside of ourselves and see if we have those faults or not. And that's what I find so beneficial about Shantideva's writings, Nagarjuna's writings, also Jay Rinpoche, you know, and the thought training writings, is they point the stuff out, you know, without any apologies, without any sugarcoating. Yeah? And I find that way of doing things very effective for my mind because I'm rather dense. And if somebody sugarcoats it, you know, I taste the sugar and stay with the sugar and forget what's under the sugar. Yeah? Okay. So, really see our own faults, work on them, you know, try to counteract them. And so in that way, really care about what the wise say. Yeah, not just kind of shine it on and say, well, you know, His Holiness said that, but that doesn't really pertain to me. You know, my teacher said that, but, you know, that applies to somebody else. Okay, you know, to look in ourselves and see how it applies. And then also, you know, help others to eliminate their faults. Yeah. So this doesn't mean going around telling them their faults. We already do that. We don't need to be encouraged to do it more. But rather, it means that if it will benefit somebody else to talk about a fault in ourselves and how we're handling it, then we can reveal that to somebody else and tell them. But we have to be very careful when we do that, that it's a fault that we have a handle on, because otherwise we may talk about our fault in a way that we're actually eliciting sympathy or approval or something else from the other person that we're telling it to. Okay? So, for example, this thing I just said, I didn't get chosen for this thing. So if I tell you, oh, you know, they didn't choose me, you know, there were all these other people, and, you know, I really wanted to go. And, yeah, I you know, there was some ego in me in wanting to do that, but I really wanted to go. Then what are you going to say? Yeah. You're going to say, you know, you were really competent to go. Yeah? And you're very disappointed, and I don't know why they didn't choose you, because there's many other people. You know, there's many people, but, you know, you're really unique. Yeah? So do you get what I mean? how sometimes we can talk about our own faults, but we're eliciting somebody else's saying something nice to us or comforting us or telling us it's really not a fault. Yeah. Okay, so we have to be careful when we do that, that it's actually something that we have a handle on. Or if we're revealing a difficult situation and how we resolved it, that it's something that we, in fact, have resolved. And we're not, again, you know, putting out feelers, wanting something, emotional support, approval, something, something from somebody else. Yeah? Okay. So Kenzin Rinpoche also warns us here. He says, in general, it's hard to find people who regularly speak of others' good qualities. You know, usually everybody's looking for everybody else's bad qualities and jumps on them, even if they're tiny, and points them out. Okay? So, he says, you may become a great pandit through your study, contemplation, and meditation. But if in other areas you have a fault, you know, in the eyes of others, that fault will outshine all your qualities. And it's true, that's how we look at people, isn't it? They may have many good qualities, but if they have a fault, and especially if it's somebody we're jealous of, yeah, we just criticize them up, down, and across. Okay? And so he's saying, you know, that's what people may do to you because this is the way sentient beings are. So don't become conceited. Because if you become conceited, you know, people sniff that out and they see that as a fault and they will let you know. Unless, of course, you've succeeded in fooling them, and they think your fault is a good quality, in which case that's very dangerous for you. You know, it's much better for somebody to point out a fault that we have than for us to have convinced them that our fault is a good quality and them encouraging that in us. Okay, then 271. Do not be angry when others do harm, but realize that it is the effect of previous karma. Without causing any more suffering, eliminate your own faults. Thought training, isn't it? You can see exactly where the thought training came from. Now, isn't it, before I explain this verse, isn't it interesting how all these kinds of things about conceit and faults and pretension and deceit and all these things fall under wisdom. Yeah. It's very easy to forget that. Think, oh, these are just fault, you know, thought training teachings. But these are falling under things that we have to really look at in order for the collection of wisdom to grow in us. And you can see with all these things, there's a big fat me at the center of them, isn't there? Okay, so when others harm you, see it as the effect of your own karma. Okay, so instead of blaming somebody else, yeah, see, this would not have happened to me if I had not created the cause for it. There is nothing to blame in the other person's behavior. Or, if there is something to blame, it's not for me to blame it. That other person will experience the result of their own karma. But the main thing is, right now I'm experiencing the result of my karma. So instead of creating more negative karma by accusing somebody and blaming somebody and shaming somebody, you know, just accept this is the result of my own negative karma and be humble about it. You know, I'm experiencing the result, and you know, you can start to imagine the kind of things you must have said and done in a previous life. And then when you do that, if you can't think of anything, read The Wheel of Sharp Weapons. Yeah, you know, Dharma Rakshita is very good at pointing out things we probably did in previous lives that warrant the experiences that we have now. And, you know, really think about it. And it's very humbling. Yeah, it's like, oh, in a previous life, I was pretty disgusting. Yeah? This is the kind of behavior I did that brought on what I'm experiencing. I must have been really unpleasant and obnoxious. Okay, it's very humbling. Which is good for us. Okay. Then also as part of this, okay, here we have the four ascetic practices for bodhisattvas. So these came up in the Chenrezig practice. They come up in many different situations, these four. Okay. So, and in the bodhisattva vows, they're also in the bodhisattva vows. When insulted, do not retaliate by insulting the other. Easy or hard?
Hard.
When somebody hits you, don't hit them back. That is downright un-American. Yeah. We're taught somebody hits you, you hit them back.
Harder.
Yeah. Somebody does something you don't like, you bomb them. Okay? Yeah. When others are angry at you, do not respond with anger. Oh, come on, just a little bit. They deserve it. It's for their own benefit. Okay, we justify. When others observe your faults, do not react by commenting on theirs. Why not? Everything should be fair. They commented on my fault, I should comment on theirs. We're equal opportunity employers. Okay? So these are the four ascetic practices of bodhisattvas. And these four ascetic practices are much better for taming our mind than, you know, starving ourselves and not eating or, you know, these kind of sleeping on concrete and, you know, doing some kind of ascetic trip. I mean, don't you think so? These are much, much more. Because sometimes when we do the physical ascetic practices, we can get some ego gratification from it, can't we? Other people say, oh, look at him or her. You know, they're so renounced. They sleep on the concrete floor. They only eat, you know, half a meal a day. They, you know, do whatever it is. They're so renounced. They're talking about me, you know. Whereas these four, we're not going to get any ego boost out of them, are we? Yeah, somebody insults us, we keep our mouth closed. Somebody hits us, we keep our hands by our side. Somebody's angry at us, we don't retort back. Somebody points out our faults, we don't criticize them back. We're not getting any ego points for that, are we? Yeah. So you see, you know, real practice is not going to enlarge our ego. Yeah? So stop looking for all kinds of subterranean ways in which we can look like great practitioners and get some praise when actually our motivation is rotten. I remember, you know, that these ascetic things. When I lived at Kaupan, there was, we were already pretty ascetic. We didn't have to try too hard. You know, so most of us had, you know, the Western Sangha, we were sleeping in this one building, and it had brick floors. It was just brick. It was pretty cold. But most of us got some kind of, you know, some kind of mattress. They didn't have foam mattresses, so it was some kind of straw mattress to sleep on. But there was one monk who just put his bag on the floor, or at most he put just a mat, not a mattress, but just, you know, a mat. And Lama Yeshe came in one day and said, "What kind of Milarepa trip are you doing? You know, you're not Milarepa. Get yourself a mattress. You're going to get sick if you sleep on the cold brick." Yeah. So when somebody tried to do Milarepa trip, he would call them on it. Yeah. He would call us on it. Okay. Should we pause here? If there's maybe there's some questions and discussion. Yeah.
Just the enumeration, we kind of got lost about number 17. So these last couple of verses, I wonder if you could.
Oh, okay. So number 16 was not maliciously talking about the faults of others. So that's from verse 269. 17 is to examine your own errors. Okay. 18 is, thinking about what the wise say and then see if you have those faults and counteracting them. Okay. And also included in 18 is helping others counteract their faults. Okay. Then 19 is when others harm you, not to explode in anger. Okay, so that's verse 271. And that, as part of 19, that's where you have those four ascetic practices. Okay, other questions, comments?
Those first three, maybe, especially the first three ones, maybe really depend, lately I've been finding that enemies that I have the faults that I want to correct. So that's why I'm making them like an enemy. And then 6 months later I go, oh, wait, that's why I didn't like that person. Because I do that.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Very often we can see that the faults we pick in other people are things we have in ourselves. Yeah. Very often it's like that. Yeah. Uh-huh.
And we can often see that, we can use that as an opportunity to see and deal with those faults.
Right, yeah. If you're doing the thought training, when you see a fault in somebody else, then you say to yourself, this is what I look like when I act that way. Instead of pointing the finger at them, learn from their example. That's what I look like.
Would that also be under the equanimity as though, like, I have someone who's offended against me, but that doesn't mean that they're an offensive person because we all have our good and bad qualities.
Right.
So a person may be a murderer, but they may be a wonderful father.
Yeah, exactly.
So would that be under equanimity?
That's more a thing of not... of separating the person and the action. That the action can be something that is inappropriate or harmful, but that doesn't mean the person is evil. Yeah. But if you really follow that out, it does act as a reason to have equanimity towards other people, towards everybody. Yeah. Because we all do have faults. But we are not our faults.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, in those moments, I'm, you know, criticizing someone in my mind, like, and occasionally now, I can catch it and say, how do I do that? Ask myself, how do I do that same thing? And I can almost always find how I do some version of the very same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. How we're doing some version of what we find.
Yeah. How is it that I do that same thing?
Yeah. So you're saying to ask yourself, how does that manifest in me?
Yeah. That's
how does that fault come out in me?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Might be a little different style, but I'm doing.
Oh yeah. Thing. Yeah. We have our own flavor and style. Yes.
I had an experience recently where I got into this long, drawn-out interfaith dialogue, and I didn't think it was going to go as long as it did, but it ended up going quite long, and he ended up giving me an article that he had written. He was a born-again Christian, and at first I accepted it, thinking that I was showing him that I'm open to hearing about it, but then at the end of the conversation I decided to give it back because I knew I wasn't going to read it. So I'm sort of wondering, in that situation, really thinking about the first verse you were talking about, is it better to accept or to say, you know, no, I'm Buddhist, and I just wanted to have a conversation.
Okay. So you were having an interfaith discussion with somebody. Did you tell them that you were Buddhist?
Yeah.
Okay, and was it a real discussion, or were they trying to convince you of their...
It started to lean more, they were trying to convince me.
Yeah. Okay, so sometimes it starts out as a discussion, and then they're trying to convince you, and then they give you something to read. Yeah? Yeah. So, I remember one airplane flight I had, I was sitting next to this one young man, and, you know, it kind of went a similar kind of thing. And I let him know I was Buddhist, and he wanted to give me something to read. And I said, thank you, and I would like to give you something to read. And he froze. And he said, I can't accept that. You know, my pastor said, I can't do that. Then I said, then I'm really sorry. I can't accept what you gave me either. And I gave it back to him. Yeah? And in situations where I feel somebody's trying to convince me and not really listening, it's not a real dialogue, but they're trying to convince me, then I usually say, you know, I don't feel respected. Yeah? And if we're going to have a dialogue, you know, I need respect for my beliefs. I don't need to be told that I'm going to hell. Yeah? And if you say you're telling me out of compassion, then I'm going to tell you what my religion says out of compassion for you. And see, you know, see what's going on with the person. Yeah?
When we examine our own faults, how do we take care to not completely get involved in demeaning ourselves?
Oh, why do you always have to ask this question? You know, everybody all the time, whatever you say, they always say, but I'm such an awful person. You know? Why is everybody just trashing themselves? And why do you bug me so much? Yeah, I've answered this question 50 million times already. Haven't I? Well, maybe not 50 million, maybe only 49. But, you know, but really, you know, what I asked that speaker and I want to reply. What ideas do you have for how not to fall to the extreme of demeaning yourself and thinking you're worthless? Okay, please write in a reply, and then when it comes, read it.
Yeah?
I mean, because if I answer this, you're not going to remember it. Because you've heard it before, and you haven't remembered it. So now you need to tell me what your ideas are. Yes?
I just recently read in a biography from a Chinese master about how to deal with competitiveness and jealousy behavior. And I found very inspiring. He said, you know, compete with Chen Weizi instead of somebody else, because that's actually the quality you want to develop. And so you have to apply those kind of attitudes you as a buyer to become like Chen Weizi.
Yeah. Okay, so somebody said to compete with Chen Weizi in the sense that you aspire to become Chen Weizi. Yeah. Gee, Chen Weizi, you have 1,000 arms.
I'm worthless.
I only have 2. And then Chen Weizi says, well, you know, this is a 2-arm form of Chen Weizi too.
Regarding respect in this regard, when we criticize somebody else, there's a lack of respect, I would think. Mm. And how does this come about? I'm not so clear. When I criticize somebody else, I'm not, my view is not really right at that moment. I'm not seeing the full person with all their qualities. Mm-hmm. I'm pointing on the small thing.
Yeah.
It's disturbing for my mind, because originally my mind is already disturbed. It's not the person. The person just triggers something. I'm coming already from an unbalanced mind.
Right.
And so maybe I had to respect beforehand, maybe on the day before or just an hour before, but then there's something triggering me and I'm losing respect and I'm doing something what's maybe hurting that person, that criticizing you.
Yeah.
It's, I don't
was mean, there a question there?
Yeah, I don't really get it. Why do I lose respect in one minute?
Wow. Are you asking why does your mind change?
Is the respect maybe not really there, actually? Because if I imagine I have respect like towards a teacher, this is more seem to be stable, but why can't it be?
Because you have afflictions. It doesn't. Because you have afflictions. Why do you lose respect for people you used to respect? Because you have afflictions. It doesn't matter if it's the person, it's the teacher. You know, it doesn't matter who it is. If somebody says something that we don't like, if they do something we don't like, they have a fault. If they have a fault, that's a good reason for me not to respect them. Yeah? And it's all due to it's our own afflictions. Yeah? Nothing magical. Yeah? Do we have a response?
So the person said, this is more a question about our culture in general that feeds us ideas about our self-worth, right? And then I said, do you believe those ideas? And the person said, no. So I said, okay, what helps you? And they said, it's realizing that it is our society's values that are at fault or are different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that was one idea that the person had for how not to get so down on yourself, is to realize that you receive conditioning from your society to criticize yourself, but that you have the internal clarity of mind and the internal power to say, I don't believe what society has conditioned me to think about myself. Is that what they're saying?
I think so.
Yeah, so that's good. So see, you figured it out yourself. No, really, truly, you know? Yeah. Oh, so they're having a discussion amongst themselves online?
No, this was someone else also offered an answer.
Yeah, that's what I mean. They're having a discussion. So, yeah, so somebody said, yeah, we have Buddha nature, so very good reason. Good, yeah.
I just wanted to share that probably one of the most difficult things that the the Dharma has helped me to do is to be able to rejoice in other people's good qualities. I think about my entire life from the time I was a little person. There was no sense of being able to look at my peers, look at my elders, look at the young ones, and see them within the context of what's working for them. So it's been one of the most difficult things. I either go to jealousy or I go to condescension. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a tragedy. I think it's an absolute tragedy. And so what the Dharma has helped me to do is to I have to turn my mind, because it just goes right to the faults, goes right to the shortcomings, even when they're not the things that are manifesting. Because then if the good quality's up, then the jealousy starts. The training of my mind for the past 16 years to be able to work it around being happy for other people's good qualities. Mm-hmm. And the antidote that has helped me is, I have always, the one that I use most than any of them is, you promise to benefit other beings. And look, this person has these wonderful qualities and you haven't had to do diddly squat for them to have them. You know, so rejoice. You know, you said you wanted to help them, and here they are, already manifesting beautiful loving kindness, and you get to be the recipient, and you didn't have to do anything. But boy, what a truth. That's been one of the hardest things I've had in the Dharma.
Yeah. Okay. So the difficulty in giving up jealousy and condescension.
And rejoicing.
Yeah, and just rejoicing.
Yeah.
And that what you're saying, what you find very useful in that way is, you know, that I said I was going to benefit all sentient beings. Here somebody is. They have a good quality. They have an opportunity. Why do I resent them for having this when I said I was going to benefit them and lead them to enlightenment?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. In the Pearl of Wisdom, the Blue Book, in the section on taking refuge, there's a comment in there that I found very helpful that says we should refrain from criticizing what everything that doesn't meet with our approval.
Yeah.
And I think about that not just verbally, but mentally criticizing things. Because that critical mind is the opposite of joy. It's really error.
Yeah. Yeah. The critical mind is torture, isn't it? Judge, criticize. And it completely destroys our joy in life.
The wrong direction.
Yeah. And what's weird is the logic of the self-centered mind is, if I can make people less than, then I must be good. So self-centered mind thinks that criticizing others is going to make us feel good about ourselves because we're better than them. When in actual fact, criticizing others makes us really unhappy. And it makes us see the world as a horrible place. Yeah. Instead of being able to see other people's good qualities and rejoicing and see the goodness in the world. So you're saying of referring to the refuge guideline that says to avoid criticizing anything that meets with our disapproval. That's an ascetic practice, isn't it?
Oh, on the flip side, I was thinking last year somebody said to me, you know, I really can't think of anything else I have left to purify. And that was so scary, like, that's how arrogance coming up, right?
Yeah.
If you actually sincerely believe that, I wasn't quite sure how to respond.
Yeah. So somebody said to you, oh, I can't think of anything more I have to purify. And that's the stage for sending yourself to the lower realms, isn't it? I have nothing more to purify, so then you don't purify, so then all your negativities are still there, they're going to ripen. So, you know, you have to see who the person is and everything to see how to respond to them, you know, what your relationship with them is. because how you respond is going to be different. You know, whether you just ignore it or whether you say, you know, well, the great masters recommend that we continuously purify again and again. Yeah, even things we've already purified, they say purify again because the seeds are quite deep, you know. And so there, you're quoting the great masters, you know.
About your job interview analogy, you know, it is, we're in a competitive world, very, very competitive world, and I don't do that too well, I think, of, say, like, try to brag, but, I mean, I do it to a good enough degree to where I got the job that I have, and I'm able to do all these things because of that, and, you know, if not talking about your qualities and all of that, a lot of times you just won't compete, won't get that job, you won't be able to do any of this. Is there like a way to go about that in like a virtuous, so you can provide for yourself?
Okay, yeah, yeah. So, okay. So how to get a job you want without being, here I am, you want to hire me, over the top bragging about yourself. I think there's a way of speaking about your good qualities where you just state the matter of fact. I mean, it's a job interview. So the person is asking, what can you do? What do you know? So you answer the question. It's just an exchange of information. Yeah? You're not lying. You're not making things up. The person said, do you know how to do this? You say, yes, I know how to do this, and I used to do it here and there. Because the person's asking you for that information. So that's different than saying, you bet I know how to do that, and I was the greatest one, and my previous job, I was the top of the rank, and blah, 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 blah. You know? So I think there's a way of just, you share.
Like, I can do this, but I'm not the only one who can do it.
Yeah, but you don't say I'm not the only one.
Yeah. Yeah.
You just say, yeah, I know how to do this, and here's an example. You know, in my previous job, I did this and this and this, and that's how I used that skill. So you give an example so the person knows kind of, you know, in what way you know the skill. So I think that's fine. Because there, you know, so you have to check your motivation. Are you bragging or are you sharing information? They're two different things. Okay?
Similar to this, someone online was just saying that when we speak about teachers' good qualities, I was thinking to speak in terms of why our teacher is good, a good teacher for us, as opposed to trying to convince someone else that is how good my teacher is.
Right, yeah. So if you want to talk about your teacher's qualities, say how those qualities affect you and why that person is a good example for you, rather than putting that person up in stardom as if, you know, they should be everybody's teacher. Yeah. Okay. We have some work to do, huh? Okay, so we ended on... We're on 272. Okay.
May the spiritual teachers who lead me on the sacred path, and all spiritual friends who practice it have long life. May I pacify completely all outer and inner hindrances. Grant such inspiration, I pray. May the lives of the venerable spiritual mentors be stable, and their virtuous actions spread in the 10 directions. May the light of the sun's teachings dispelling the darkness of the beings in the three worlds always increase. Idam Guranamandala Kanyatayami.
Due to this
this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May the born have no decline, but increase forevermore. In the snowy mountain pure land, you're the source of good and happiness, powerful tenting yet so generously. May you stay until samsara ends. May the deeds of explaining and practicing the Dharma, done by groups supporting the teachings and their upholders, who spread the view of dependent arising,